In this episode, we are going to be drinking to excess the Sandaman Founders Reserve Ruby, which is unusual. I haven't had the Ruby. I've had the Sandaman Private Reserve.
Tawny.
Yeah.
I think there was that one at the store, but I hadn't tried this one either.
Oh, that's Bundy.
There you go.
Thank you.
I'd like more than my wife got, please.
I can guarantee that.
Hmm.
How did I do that? It's magical. Paradise Lost, Chapter 9. The Doctrine of the Unchanging Human Heart. Men do mightily wrong themselves when they refuse to be present in all ages and neglect to see the beauty of all kingdoms. I don't know how to pronounce that.
Traherne.
We have hitherto been concerned almost exclusively with the form of Paradise Lost, and it is now time to turn to its matter. Here also the modern reader finds difficulties. Mr. Brian Hone, the cricketer and schoolmaster, once told me that he had reconciled his boys to the need we find for notes in reading Milton by pointing out how many notes Milton would need if he read a modern book. The device is a happy one. If Milton returned from the dead and did a week's reading in the literature of our own day, consider what a crop of questions he might bring to you. It would carry you far afield to make him understand how liberal, sentimental, and complacent had become terms of disapproval. And before you had finished, you would find that you had embarked on the exposition of a philosophy rather than on merely lexical questions. Now, when we read Paradise Lost, the positions are reversed. Milton is on his own ground, and it is we who must be the learners.
How are these gulfs between the ages to be dealt with by the student of poetry? A method often recommended may be called the method of the unchanging human heart. According to this method, the things which separate one age from another are superficial. Just as, if we strip the armor off a medieval knight or the lace off a Caroline courtier, we should find beneath them an anatomy identical with our own, so it is held if we strip off from Virgil his Roman imperialism, from Sidney his code of honor, from Lucretius his Epicurean philosophy, and from all who have it their religion, we shall find the unchanging human heart. And on this we are to concentrate. I held this theory myself for many years, but I have now abandoned it. I continue, of course, to admit that if you remove from people the things that make them different, what is left must be the same, and that the human heart will certainly appear as unchanging if you ignore its changes.
Smartass.
But I have come to doubt whether the study of this mere LCM is the best end the student of old poetry can set before himself. If we are in search of the LCM, then, in every poem, we are tempted to treat as the most important those elements which belong to the LCM, which remain when we have finished the stripping off process. But how if these are not really the most important elements in the actual balance of the poem we are reading? Our whole study of the poem will then become a battle between us and the author, in which we are trying to twist his work into a shape he never gave it, to make him use the loud pedal where he really used the soft, to force into false prominence what he took in his stride, to slur over what he actually threw into bold relief. The older modern reading of Dante, with its disproportionate emphasis on the Inferno and within the Inferno, on the episode of Paolo and Francesca, is an example of this. The common concentration on the satiric elements in Jean de Moon's continuation of The Romance of the Rose is another. Sometimes, too, the features to which we give this false prominence are not really manifestations of some specially unchanging element in humanity at all, but merely those in which the long process of change has thrown up a similarity between the old author and the modern mood. We find not the unchanging, but a fortunate resemblance to our own modification. like the Scotchman who thought the Greek infantry must be sound Presbyterians at heart because they wore kilts. Under this delusion, we may be led to suppose that Virgil is specially expressive of the unchanging human heart in the Dido episode, or that the death of Absalom is more central than the death of Abel. I do not say that even on these terms we shall not get some value out of our reading, but we must not imagine that we are appreciating the works the old writers actually wrote.
Fortunately, there is a better way. Instead of stripping the knight of his armor, you can try to put his armor on yourself. Instead of seeing how the courtier would look without his lace, you can try to see how you would feel with his lace. That is, with his honor, his wit, his royalism, and his gallantries out of the Grand Cyrus. I had much rather know what I should feel like if I adopted the beliefs of Lucretius than how Lucretius would have felt if he had never entertained them.
Amen.
The possible Lucretius in myself interests me more than the possible C.S. Lewis in Lucretius.
Amen. Oh, fire. This is my favorite. Okay, go on. I just love this.
There is in G.K. Chesterton's Avowals and Denials a wholly admirable essay called On Man, Heir of All the Ages. An heir is one who inherits, and any man who is cut off from the past is a man most unjustly disinherited. To enjoy our full humanity, we ought, so far as is possible, to contain with us potentially at all times and on occasion to actualize all the modes of feeling and thinking through which man has passed. You must, so far as in you lies, become an Achaean chief while reading Homer, a medieval knight while reading Mallory, an 18th century Londoner while reading Johnson. Only thus will you be able to judge the work in the same spirit that its author writ, and to avoid chimerical criticism. It is better to study the changes in which the being of the human heart largely consists than to amuse ourselves with fictions about its immutability. For the truth that is, when you have stripped off what the human heart actually was in this or that culture, you are left with a miserable abstraction, totally unlike the life really lived by any human being. To take an example from a simple matter, human eating. When you have abstracted all that is peculiar to the social and culinary practical practice of different times and places, resolves itself into the merely physical, human love, abstracted from all the varying taboos, sentiments, and ethical discriminations which have accompanied it, resolves itself into something capable only of medical treatment, not of poetical.
Medical treatment, not of poetical treatment.
Yikes.
Logicians will perceive that the fallacy of the unchanging human heart is one more instance of the LCM view of the universal. The idea that an engine is most truly an engine if it is neither driven by steam, nor gas, nor electricity, neither stationary nor locomotive, neither big nor small, but in reality you understand enginehood or humanity or any other universal precisely by studying all the different things it can become, by following the branches of the tree, not by cutting them off.
We must therefore turn a deaf ear to Professor Surratt when he invites us to study what there is of lasting originality in Milton's thought, and especially to disentangle from theological rubbish the permanent and human interest. This is like asking us to study Hamlet after the rubbish of the revenge code has been removed, or centipedes when free of their irrelevant legs, or Gothic architecture without the pointed arches. Milton's thought, when purged of its theology, does not exist. Our plan must be very different, to plunge right into the rubbish, to see the world as if we believed it, and then, while we still hold that position in our imagination, to see what sort of a poem results.
In order to take no unfair advantage, I should warn the reader that I myself am a Christian, and that some, by no means all, of the things which the atheist reader must try to feel as if he believed, I actually, in cold prose, do believe. For the student of Milton, my Christianity is an advantage. What would you not give to have a real, live Epicurean at your elbow while reading Lucretius?
Mm. All right. Yeah, I know. It's so good and short.
Yes.
When I run small on smalls, small group on small groups, I ask them to read The Doctrine of the Unchanging Heart and Lucifer. There's only two chapters from this book, and I ask him to purchase the book, and then we go over it from there. And you can see how this relates to the cultural question. When we approach the doctrine of the unchanging human heart, I see a lot of flat contradictions. Lewis flatly contradicts a lot of what I've learned in the evangelical Christian tradition and what I take to be the Puritan tradition. So when we approach something and we say music is bad, which has been the position of some churches through the ages, right? Music is by itself just inherently evil. And I'm like, how do you get there? Like, how does this work? Well, it's a this and it's a that. And as you begin to pare away some of their theology, you find that there is, as odd as it may sound, there is inherent in that an element of the doctrine of the unchanging human heart, which is humanistic. Mm. Now, the irony isn't lost on me that those who oppose cultural expression in the name of rejecting culture, right, ultimately subcreate their own culture with codes. And it seems that culture is inescapable. So even though the Amish are trying so hard to reject culture, they have created an entire subculture.
Yeah, they have their own Amish style.
Yeah, they got their
stylish wagons and dresses.
Their
and
own
suits.
Vintage of legalism.
Yeah, their own
vintage. Like all we do.
Yeah, and the aesthetic that goes along with that. And in order to understand the Amish traditions, you don't strip them of these traditions, the culture that they have essentially cultivated. You're going to have to get into that culture in order to understand their writings, in order to understand their ideas, in order to even understand their language, which is kind of hilarious to me.
I mean, where you could kind of go with that is the idea of, well, if you took an Amish person and be like, what if we threw them into a really weird scenario that they would never be like at a rave? Like, let's take an Amish at a rave, the unchanging Amish heart, you know, and, but that would never work. You couldn't understand an Amish person by putting them out of place or trying to take them out of their culture, out of their environment. It'd be, if you wanted to actually understand them, it'd be, you know, go put on your hat and your trousers and your Amish jacket and go join them.
And so when we look at, I think it was Taylor Caldwell, and he did, I hope I'm getting this right. It might not be Taylor Caldwell. I want to say Taylor Caldwell. That's not right. Anyway, there was this missionary. He's a famous missionary whose name I can't remember. And he goes to China, and he's there with the English, and the English are all there, and they're all dressed the way they're dressed, and they all behave the way they behave. So he decides this isn't working. His wife dies, and I think his kids die as well. And he's very committed to what's going on in China. So he gets rid of his English clothes, and he buys a bunch of Chinese clothes, and he grows his hair out and braids it like a Chinaman. And he learns the language, and he eats the food they eat, and he lives in the style of huts that they live in, and so on and so forth. And pretty soon he's seen as a Chinaman, and he's able to understand their culture, live and breathe in their culture, and bring the gospel that way.
Yeah.
And then they're able to trace, because he wound up remarrying while he was on the mainland, and they're able to trace his offspring throughout China's history. And what Christianity that exists in China to this day is somewhat credited to this missionary. And missionary after missionary that had been sent by England would show up, do missionary work for a set period of time, and then return to England, never integrating, never actually really doing it, right?
Yeah.
And we see this now with a great many American missionaries, there was a tradition that was created where the English would show up, and that, you know, they call it colonialism. Colonialism, by and large, has served, like British colonialism has served the world extremely well. They're better off because the English were there. But so that's not my argument. But the people that were showing up were trying to convert people to their culture and to Christianity. Whereas what the biblical example might be is to go in and convert them to Christianity and then transform culture. So a question that it then comes to mind, or at least comes to hand, is these folks that go and do missionary work but don't actually buy into the culture, you know, they're not discerning, you know, there are elements of Chinese culture that you don't want to do. I'm not going to bind, foot binding is not something we're ever going to do. But I can wear silk and grow my hair out. Like, you can tell that what's biblical and what's anti-biblical, what's what works and what doesn't work in terms of where you're going to fight those battles. But if you show up and you're like, well, I'm just here to help the barbarians become more civilized, which tends to be an attitude of Christian missionaries, then you're not going to get a foothold that creates multi-generational change.
Yeah. Right. So you'd almost have to ask them to reject not only their beliefs around whatever gods they had, but you're asking them to, you know, reject their entire culture, which isn't unredeemable. Or, well, that's actually a good question. Kind of going through my mind is, when you have a culture built upon belief in religion or a god or a deity, that it becomes incorporated probably in every level of your culture.
Yes.
When it, you know, all the way down from the top to the bottom in some way.
Yeah. In a lot of ways it does. Yeah.
And so how do you make that switch of saving the people to believe in God instead of whatever gods or whatever they were serving before?
And if we take the principle, so staying in alignment with what you just, with the question you just begged, right? Let's say that what we do in a small way, we do in a big way. So we see it amplified, but this level of thinking still exists within us as Christians here in America, in the United States. I noticed that at family gatherings, there were those that were Christians and those that were not Christians. And the not Christians would behave in a way that conveyed that their extreme discomfort as it related to the Christians. And a lot of it had to do with the lifestyle that they chose. Now, this was very interesting to me because one of the problems that really plagued Christian church was, especially if I'm second generation Christian, I'm a good little Christian boy, and I go and I relate to the non-Christians, they can't, it seemed as if they just couldn't even relate to me. They couldn't identify with me. I was pure. I was perfect. I was all these things. And they saw themselves as contaminated or evil in my eyes, that I was somehow damning them because I didn't do drugs and didn't sleep around. Sometimes it was that simple in Zilla. And so I started to, you know, kind of question that. And I started to say, all right, so how do I break that barrier? You know, how do I break that barrier? You know, Jim, you grew up in the school system. How do you break that barrier?
Well, hopefully there is some level of good that they're willing to operate on, kind of called up, and not just operate at the lowest level. And so, you know, I'm willing to operate at, I'm not willing to forsake my commitments to my faith and just blend in, kind of chameleon myself in. And don't get me wrong, there was that temptation. And at some times, you know, I would find myself kind of in lockstep with the other people, and someone wouldn't be able to distinguish me from, you know, an unsaved person, trying to find a level that they'd be willing to operate or, you know, relate to me on. But, you know, they might not want to relate to me on a level like that of just shared They might not have a belief in God, but they'd be willing to, you know, have some beliefs or qualities of, you know, not lying or being kind. Or I guess what I'm trying to say is we'd have a shared values. Like I would try to find shared values with them that I could operate with them on. And then we could operate at that level, but we couldn't operate at a higher level because they didn't share those values with me.
See, and that was something that kind of jumped out for me was, and this was something that came up with me was that, we, as a homeschool kid, pastor's kid in the 90s, growing up in the 80s, homeschooled, there was an aesthetic, there was a language, there was a, the way we dressed, the kind of cars we even drove was sometimes influenced, you know, depending on what the issue was, heavily by our decisions. Like, we're not going to go get a convertible Ford Mustang, for example. Mm-hmm. We're not going to get a tattoo. Now, one of them might be somewhat biblical, but the other is just the culture that we've made up. So differentiating between a cultural thing that we've subcreated, like the Amish, and something that's a biblical thing, like, hey, don't go out there and sleep around. Mm-hmm. So is this cultural or is this not? So in the conversation that I had with a coworker, he said, you're just a goody two shoes Christian, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you really want it, but I kind of like you, I think, you know, cause I was witty. Mm. He said, hey, if you want to go hang out sometime and, you know, do some drugs and maybe get laid or something like that. He basically invited me to go do that, you know, with his set, which was mm-hmm. very bold of him, I thought. And I looked at him and I've told this story many times, but I told the guy, this was at the Chevron and so on. I said, then I can be happy, content, and fulfilled like you. And he laughed and he said, right. Cause he was miserable. And then I pranked the cops and got fired. So that was kind of the story there. But when I pranked the cops, he was surprised, you know, because this was not, Jared is not going to go have sex with people that he's not married to, and he's not going to do drugs, and he's not going to get drunk, but he's totally going to prank the cops. So one of the things that had come up for me was that there are things that we have done, these extra rules that we created that aren't necessarily related to biblical law, that aren't necessarily the fight that we're supposed to be fighting. And I don't understand it, but for whatever reason, we find ourselves taking that culture and then saying, this is all equivalent. With my dad, it was kind of absurd, but with my dad, wearing your hat backwards and using bad words were equivalent to a bunch of other sins. And I'm like, using bad words is not biblical. Like, that's a mire. You don't want to get dragged down into that. Who gets to decide what the bad words are? Is it Christianity that's deciding that? Is it the Bible that decides that? Or is it the culture that decides that? Because right now the culture decides.
Right. Because the words can change.
Right. Faggot is the new F word.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting in a group, like the way I would describe this is I'm sitting in a group with a bunch of doctors and they were saying fuck all the time. Like every other word, they thought they were edgy. They all grew up in the 60s and 70s. They all graduated from med school sometime in the 80s. Right. I think. And so they're all there. They're super edgy. Oh my gosh. And I'm just laughing at them because if I actually dropped the F word, the real F word, they would all clutch their pearls and feel uncomfortable. Right?
Exactly.
Because what has changed in the culture is what is naughty has changed in the culture. And it wasn't the Christians that decide that. So if we're bending over backwards to play by the rules that the Christians didn't actually make, what are we doing? Now, initially, and why the doctrine of the unchanging heart is so important is I'll have people read it and I'll say, okay, guys, to what extent do we put on the armor? In order to understand the culture we're in, to what extent are we putting on the armor? And I'm not talking about the full armor of God. For reading Milton, and we're putting on his mind, his theology, in order to understand his poetry, right? So to what extent are we putting on the armor in order to understand the culture we're in? And then to what extent, how practically are we asking people to put on our armor? All right, I tried out your game. Now try this. Put this on. Mm-hmm. Now, I have actually done this. I have an actual suit for you to put on, an entire worldview you're going to put on with this suit. And I'm going to give you a preachification, and then we're going to go out there and we're going to try out this art.
Hmm. Right, right. I mean, that's really interesting, because if you put on Milton's thinking, the first thing that would come up with me is that is quite hard to do, because, you know, I don't know all that much, really, about the people that lived back then, that much about Milton. But I think what I could at least do is hold back the thoughts that would say, that's silly, because it's not like my culture now. I mean, or I don't understand that, and I think it's dumb because we do things differently here. Because I think you have to learn and to experience what that worldview is, and try to, you know, whichever way you can, like, put that on. And it might take a while to put that on, but I think you can at least not drag your own stuff with you and refuse to take your own stuff off from your culture. I read this really interesting book, fictional book, about this guy who gets transported to, like, ancient Scottish, this world, and he gets transported right into the middle of a battle, and his friend had been transported there earlier. Now, he arrives, and there's this full-on battle going on, and he arrives regular 21st century clothes, and he has a watch on, and his hair looks a certain way, and his friend, like, spots him, runs up, and he's like, you have to take all that stuff off right now, because we're in this middle of this battle, and you're about to be killed, or in the world that they were in, they all fought pretty much naked, and so he just strips it all off, and it's just this really interesting, takes his watch and throws it into a little brook next to him, and then he goes and, you know, fights this battle, and then the rest of the book is him learning about this culture, but he couldn't bring all his stuff with him. He had to take it off, and, like, literally, like, it's very stark there. It's like, literally, just strip it off, all of it.
Well, one of the books that I've enjoyed that is a tongue-in-cheek accidental examination of this doctrine of the unchanging heart is A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, which is a super long book. Super long book by Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. And it is the tongue-in-cheek take on this question, all right? And, of course, it's absurd. It's patently absurd. There's no way he would have pulled off what he pulls off in the book, in my opinion. But this idea that we are essentially tasked with converting the hearts and minds of people, and culture is part of the battle, is what I'm appealing to. If you go overseas and you try to fight the battle and you just try to bring your American evangelicalism with you, you can't do that. You have to pare it back to good, sound theology and then learn to read the books they're reading with their mindset and fight that battle there, which is part of the reason why I strongly contend that we should instead be using our resources to bankroll people who are already there and converting them to Christianity and let them fight that battle. Enable them to fight that battle. We're losing the battle here. We don't need to go somewhere else and lose the battle. Harder. So as far as I'm concerned, and I feel strongly about this, every Christian needs to start seeing themselves as a missionary, as a guerrilla here, a guerrilla warfare kind of guerrilla here in the United States. And in order to do that, we need to be thinking, or at least conscious of this idea that there is a culture war, and that culture includes, in order for them to participate in what we're doing, they have to put on some of the stuff we're doing culturally. In order for us to understand how to connect with them, that we need to put on some of their stuff culturally. It doesn't mean that I'm out there dressing like a transvestite so that I can reach transvestites.
Oh, good, because that would be...
That'd be your next question. That'd be great, Adam. What are you talking about?
Oh, there's some mental images I don't want to ponder.
Now, the reason why this is unusual is common. It's not going to be normal with the 12 people that are listening to this podcast. This is old hat. And some of it's just picked up by osmosis. Like, we don't even think about it. We just take it for granted. But it is actually a major stumbling block for a lot of the boomer generation. This is a major stumbling block even for our own generation that didn't grow up kind of understanding the interplay. So when I interact with folks where I'm like, your homeschoolers are awkward. They don't know how to dress. They don't know how to dress in a way that is at least not off-putting. Socially, they're awkward. They don't know how to behave themselves in social situations, especially in social situations where we're giving, it's called dishing, but there's a ton of different ways, taking the piss out of somebody, giving somebody a hard time.
Yeah, just teasing somebody. Yeah.
We can call it teasing. We can call it giving them shit is another way that they put it. So in truck driving, you have to learn how to go back and forth and how to play the game, the social game of giving each other grief. And then you also have to be able to be nimble enough not to take the chicken exit every once in a while and invite people into the reality of what you walk in. So for me, I communicate what my financial situation is in explicit terms, which everyone is surprised by, because normally you don't do that. You're not. It's considered unseemly in evangelicalism to tell people how much money you make in a year. Mm-hmm. Why?
That's one of those extra little rules that we've equated with, well, that's just not proper. That's not nice.
That's not nice. Yeah. That's not
that
nice.
Might make somebody else feel
dear.
Insecure, or you might be seen as boasting,
or they might take advantage of you,
or they might look down on you for how little you make.
Do we understand it? But if I'm like, hey, how much do you make a year? That's considered an impertinent question. Mm-hmm. Especially if that person is a CEO or is well to do or something like that.
I think it's just as bad as if you ask a poor person.
I don't know. There's an awful lot of people that work at gas stations. Tell me exactly what they make. Well, complaining.
Mm-hmm.
See, if you're poor, if you're really, really poor, you're allowed to complain about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's another cultural thing. And so I'll tell people how much I made last year, gross, or I'll tell people how much I made net. I'll tell people how much I got in savings, how many houses I own, a billion, by the way. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on it goes. And then they'll be surprised. And then they could choose to tell me how much they make. Because you know one thing that's really common to man is, how do I survive?
Mm-hmm.
Especially men. Like, here's how much I made. Here's how much I've spent. And why am I in a financial crisis or whatever?
Mm-hmm.
The big one is, how do I spend more time with my kids and still provide for my family? Mm-hmm. This is a conundrum for truck drivers.
Yeah. That does seem to be the problem I've noticed with other truck drivers. Or at least truck drivers' children. It's like, yeah, Dad wasn't around very much.
Yeah, I didn't really. I forgot what he looked like. Standout parts of this book. Oh, there's so much. There's so much. There's like the whole chapter is fire.
Yeah.
Yes.
The thing I kind of wanted to touch upon is, I think when you encounter culture and you don't know what to do with it, or you don't like it very much, you just want to strip it away. That's like a easy solution, is just strip it all off. Like, I don't like it, or I don't understand it, so I'll just get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which begs the question, what is culture shock?
Just, it's not my culture.
Yeah.
I'm not used to this. I don't know what I'm doing, or you don't understand the rules. It's like, ready? Let's play the game. And you're like, I don't know how to know the rules. And you're like, you're not doing very good. Come on, pick up the pace. And you're like, I don't even know the rules harder.
Yeah, that episode with Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan, where he says, want to play a game? And Rogan says, yes. Peterson's, all right, you go first. And he goes, well, what do I do?
Don't you know the rules?
So you need rules. You need rules. And that's what it is. It's a bunch of ethics. It's a bunch of little rules is culture. Little rules equal culture, right? So if I come in and I'm saying, okay, we're going to challenge this little rule over here. And then we're going to add this rule over here. So you can do that inside of a culture. when you come from outside, extremely removed from the culture, you come in and you try to do that. Oh, that ain't going to work. It's too much. You don't even know where the real battles are. You don't know where the pressure points are. You don't know what's going to be a tipping point for people. You don't know. You don't know what the little rules are to break.
Right. And then if you see somebody who comes in and just says, I don't understand the rules, I'm just going to do whatever I want, then you call that person an ass. You're like, oh, yeah. You're just, oh, just acting like a jackass.
Yeah, so Jared over there is the worst. Doesn't he know about this rule over here?
American tourists.
American tourists. I did. I've broken a lot of rules because another thing that happens is families have rules, right? Mm-hmm. So the Myers might have an ethic around conflict that baffles me, a German. So the German side of me is like, conflict, let's go scream at each other.
I don't want to talk about it.
And Jim's like, I don't appreciate you even bringing it up in this context. And then, whereas the Emils, I have no idea what the Emils, some of the Emils rules are. But what are some rules with the Emils? Good and bad. Doesn't matter. Just pick one. Indifferent.
I know we've got lots. It's hard to think of them.
Yep. It's hard to look around at the water you're swimming in and be like, this is water.
Yeah, yeah.
Jim, what's one of our rules?
Well, one of your rules around money is that you guys definitely don't talk about it.
No, yeah, no, definitely not.
Like, yeah, never.
That's super common too. That one's a real common one.
Yep. One of your rules around, I think this comes from your grandpa, is just, people can stop in anytime.
Yeah.
That is not a common rule.
And family first.
Family, you're always going to be there first for the Emils.
Yep.
I don't know where it came from, but one of the things that Bill and Leslie had for a family rule, and they were big on this stuff, man. They came up with the thousands of rules that nobody else had from the Germans or the Bowers. They just sort of invented it. Don't coddle your kids. And that kind of translated to, if someone's there to criticize your children, allow the criticism to take place. Mm. Now, that can be problematic because it resulted in a lack of loyalty. Mm. So when I was around families that were very loyal to each other, it was bizarre. Mm. Like, what are you doing? You're going to make him weak. Mm.
Mm. That was what you believed, yeah.
Now, is that right? No, I don't think that's I don't think that's 100% right. But I can see where the loyalty thing does breed a great deal of weakness in children. Hmm. And then conversely, I've seen it breed a great deal of toxicity in relationships where there is zero loyalty. It's like, come on, man, this person over here is like the scum of the earth and he's trying to attack and destroy my reputation. And my family is there going, well, good luck, Jared. Why can't you come? Why don't you come into my corner? Why don't you help me out? Why do you got to believe them until I prove them wrong 10,000 ways and then you just kind of stop joining them in the attack is how it feels. And that's a weird ethic. And it's a difficult one because I don't want my children to have that ethic. I don't want my children to have that ethic. I want there to be some sense of loyalty. And coddling is a problem. Mm. Coddling is a big problem. It doesn't help anybody. I also don't like, I don't mean to pick on the poor old Bowers here, but it's really the Shaws. The Shaw family had placed a great deal of value in wit and getting a laugh, right? Mm-hmm. And then they also had a great deal of value in avoiding conflict at all costs. The Germans had a great deal of value in screaming at each other whenever they were mad.
Oh, interesting. That sounds like a very bubbly.
I'll tell you what it is. Confusing.
That's really interesting. Like when you take two families and their micro cultures or whatever, like their own little culture, and you jam them together, then you have to create a new culture, and there's going to be a lot of culture battles in your
family. It's a culture war. It's a culture war.
It's all the way around.
And for a lot of married couples, in the post-marital counseling that I do, which is the only one that really matters, a lot of it is, not all of it, mind you, but a lot of it really comes down to a programming or rules of what's allowed and what's not allowed, meeting conflict between the two. Mm-hmm. And the man, the husband in the relationship, needs to be the judge who's deciding what the culture is on purpose and allowing or disallowing things. within the household on purpose. Hmm. And that's kind of difficult. And that's particularly hard with folks like with the Emils, who are very disciplined in their culture. Hmm. And then you might have the Myers, who are a lot more let her fly. Mm-hmm. You know, let's just go with the flow. Let's see how this rolls out. And then you might have, in this example, you might have a default setting where we're deferring to Annalisa because it's easier. And remember, we might have the Myers going with what's easier. Let's have peace. Come on, let's just have some peace. Why do you got to make so much trouble, Jared?
That's true.
Interesting
theoretical situation. Yeah, whereas with the Bowers,
never happens.
Here. I'm going to pick on Jared for just a second. With the Freuds, there was a high value on compliance. And then, and I'm like, how did you get attracted to me? That was baffling to me. She said, well, you were confident. I'm like, but I also break all the, like, compliances. I can't be compliant.
In all the little ways.
I'm not going to double mask. I'm not going to count people who are wearing masks outside of Safeway. A job in the bureaucracy is not going to fulfill me.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and, strange.
And
would have had you picked for that.
And so you find this conflict that's between Nell and I, where she's like, two kids is what's appropriate. And it's like a major problem for a year until Ella is born, basically. There's a major, major, major crisis in our relationship. Whenever she sees me, she's mad at me. For 9 months, it was pure pain. Okay. Don't touch me. Don't look at me. What are you doing? I'm going to fight with you. And then when Ella was born, then she had a paradigm shift. But until then, holy cow.
Holy and that's cow. When she bucked the whole thing. just like,
why do you have to be this way, Jared? And this is a big deal, you know, that's in our relationship. And I know Nell's fine with it because, you know, it's in the past now. But I'm not going to bring up the, you know, the things we're fighting about right now. But it always comes down to the ethics of, my parents do it this way, my family does it this way, therefore. Mm-hmm. And I'm over here going, just because your family did it doesn't mean it's wrong. Mm-hmm. But we need to evaluate and see if this is our long-term trajectory.
Have you heard this was probably a pastoral anecdote at some point, but it was like the wife is making the Thanksgiving roast every year, and she always like chops off one end of it. And he goes, why are you doing it? And she's like, well, my mom always did it this way. So it must be right. And it's driving him crazy because it's a waste. It's a perfectly good roast. And so finally they're visiting her mom and he's like, you know, my wife always does this one thing. She says, you always did it. Like, why do you chop the end off the roast? And the mom's like, did I do that? Why would I have done that? And she goes, oh, you know what? When we lived in this one place, we had a really small oven and I needed like a smaller than normal pan and the roast just wouldn't fit in the pan. So I always had to chop it off. And so the habit got passed down.
That's all it takes. Oh, it's so true.
Yeah.
Well, that's, yeah. I mean, unwanted cultural things are just
the letter of solutions. The law without the spirit of the law. Like, yeah, we're just going to make it fit. Turns into, so we're going to chop it off. Turns into, oh, the rule is we chop it off.
Yeah.
You know, always. Not we make it fit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that was an interesting thing because when you become self-aware, you're like, okay, so Bill Bauer grew up with a father who was a philanderer and a gambler. The money programs are terrible in the Bauer family. Mm. And it's really hard on my mom. And we were poor until Bill died. And when Bill died, Leslie started building wealth, which she got from her grandfather.
Right. I mean,
that's brutal.
That's really interesting. Yeah, for my family, like alcohol was looked down upon. There was a huge, huge culture of not even having
booze is for losers.
Booze is for losers, or booze is going to take control of your life.
Leads to death.
And there's really nothing redeemable about it. And so it took a little while after leaving the home to kind of break that and realize, oh, actually, you can have alcohol without, you know, going right to alcoholism.
It can be in your house.
My parents' reactions were kind of confused after a little while, but they came around to it. And I think they realized that their ideas around it, maybe served them as far as what they needed to do, but it was kind of outdated as it came to me. You know, they were reacting to their parents and relatives they saw as alcoholics. I mean, that was the whole reason. You know, they'd tell me these horror stories of my great, you know, relatives who flushed their lives down the toilet with alcohol. And I'm looking around and be like, I haven't seen with my own eyes anybody who I can be like, oh yeah, alcoholism did that. And so when it came to me, I was like, all right, well, but it didn't, and I'm not an alcoholic. And so I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, and it I also, yeah, I think that there are extreme reactions to culture we don't like, and then we create other extreme culture. Mm-hmm. And then I also think there are culture we create because it does serve our family particularly well.
I agree.
Our unique tendencies. And I'm sure there are families where it is a great culture to have, to not have any alcohol in the house. That's just the culture we've agreed to, and it works for us, and it's really healthy. And we are just better, you know, closer to the best version of ourselves we can be with this culture in place. And then because it's working so well for us, where the fallout comes is when we also try to impose it on everyone around us. Because it's worked so well for me, like, surely this is the answer. But is it in the Bible? If it's not, then probably it's your own, you know, spiritual journey and growth and development and where you are right now and what your stumbling blocks are. So, I mean, it's not always a bad thing to have your own self-imposed cultural rules, but to try to control other people with them. That's where the legalism comes in, I think.
And I think in any expression of community, a great deal of that expression has to do with the culture that was created by the inner ring of individuals that kind of sub-created that culture, usually. But the truth is constantly in flux. So you have people that are knowingly and willfully contributing to that culture and pulling it different directions. And a lot of the conflict within any given community is which, you know, direction that culture is going to move. So as an example of this, a great deal of Christianity was all about abandoning the culture, and has been since the 1940s, at least in the U.S. So in their discipline around abandoning culture, they abandoned the Walt Disney Corporation. Mm-hmm. And we've seen what's happened recently at the Walt Disney Corporation is now they're sexist. They hate straight white males in particular, especially if they suspect they have quote-unquote conservative values, which is Christian values specifically. So they are actively hostile and toxic in that direction. Now, drawing back from that and saying, all right, that's fine, that's an example of a negative. It's an example of a positive. Well, one of the things that we're trying to create in the culture that we live in the culture of what we call affectionately and also derisively the family, right? We're trying to create a culture where you take your dynasty seriously. This is just one of the ethics that we are looking towards. So we treat every married couple as a dynasty. And this shows up in everything that we do. Not because we try really hard to make sure it does. It just accidentally comes out. Hmm. Like any good and, well, like any genuine or at least sincere culture does. They're not as self-conscious about it as you would think. They set up the habit and then they move on to the next habit. The old habit is just running in the background now. Mm-hmm. So the culture that we're currently working on is, how do you build dynasty? How do you build a dynasty? Well, you need to acquire some property. You need to also, and this is kind of important, you need to get married.
What if you want to skip that part and just sleep with them?
as hilarious as this sound, the family unit does not consist of a father, a wife, and then 1 to 27 children. It consists of just a husband and a wife. That's the family unit. That's actually the family unit. Mm-hmm. And a lot of folks, especially, you know, where parents are very centered on the children, then the children come to believe that it really is about the children. And I'm like, false. That's false, because what happens is, as soon as all the kids leave the house, the wife is annoying and ridiculous, and the husband is kind of weird, kind of checked out, kind of fed up with his wife, and he pretends not to be, but we're all like, yeah, she has too much time on her hands, because the family unit was
the kids
and the parents. And I'm not saying that it's all about the kids or it's all about the parents. I'm saying you have to be in the reality that it is. So you guys consist of the dynasty. In the garden, it was good. It was perfect. There were no kids.
That's true.
Now, I believe that we should all, you know, kids and all that
go
stuff.
Go forth and be fruitful.
Amen. But it's also true that that is the family unit. You need to know who you are before the kids leave. And so I do. Like, I love my kids. But if my kids grow up and move out of the house, I'm going to be all right. Like, oh no, what am I going to do with all this time? Yeah. My poor wife is going to be out distributing red with me. All right, so building our culture. This is a hard thing to master. This is actually a very difficult thing to master. It's easy to read this chapter and say, all right, we now understand the doctrine of the unchanging heart, and it's ridiculous, so we're going to move on now. Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa. It's not that easy. To what extent are we choosing to put on, and where do I choose to put on the culture that is outside in order to essentially trick them into buying into my culture? What are the games you're ready to play? Are you ready to belly up to the bar and play this game with me? One of the things you need to do is you need to be excellent at your craft. That's dedication and leadership. What's another thing you need to do? Well, you need to be hospitable, friendly, available, sociable with people that are outside of the family, because you want to create a culture where you're engaging the culture, not isolated from the culture. That's a family value of the Myers. That's pretty profound and very thoroughly exercised by Terry and Nancy, independent of each other. There were all kinds of people. This was a challenge for the Bowers. Bill and Leslie didn't have that value. We saw the Myers with that value. We were like, that's better than us.
Well, I mean, that's why you have friends, because sometimes you go to their house and they're like, dang, that is better. We should be like them.
I'll tell you what I learned from the Myers. They lived in town. There was no getting around it. By living in the middle of Zillah, they had more power culturally than the people who lived outside of Zillah, even if it was right outside of Zillah. And then the other thing was, it was open to all the kids all the time, and it was safe for the children. So all the neighborhood kids were coming through. And then she was hosting the Good News Club, which was super corny, even to a kid. But there was cookies. And, you know, like...
And it had a lot of fun energy, and were there.
There it is. The key was the friends were there. And then the other thing that was going on was, like, Terry is incapable of putting on airs.
I mean, that's true. He wears his emotions on his sleeve.
Yes, he does.
And so, for better or for worse.
For better or for worse.
He wears them on his sleeve. So.
Well, he does, but he also, like, he doesn't think he's better than... I've never seen him come across as thinking he's better than somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was not something the Germans were good at. And the Bowers weren't terribly good at it either. I'm not trying to dishonor anybody. I'm just saying it wasn't like... It wasn't something we were great at. And I had to learn how to not do that. And I still feel the Holy Spirit putting his finger on me every once in a while. You think you're all that?
The great thing about this chapter also is it gives you great freedom to enjoy other people and their culture. Great freedom. I mean, I think there's a temptation to take it too far and say, I'm going to be that. But to enjoy the freedom to experience it and try to understand their culture through the sense of, you know, they built it for a reason. They had some, you know, there might have been some silly parts or whatnot, but, you know, if it was a culture that has some good quality about it, then there was a reason for it. There, you know, you can find the honor, you can find the justice, you can find the love and the dedication, and those are all good things to ponder and think on and to enjoy. And, you know, when you're a kid and you're reading books about knights, that's inspiring. That imagery, you know, has been with me my entire life, of like wanting to put on the armor. Had a book, St. George and the Dragon, growing up, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be on the horse with the armor, riding out to battle a dragon or whatnot. But I think if you leave the idea of, you know, having to strip it all down, I don't know. I'm trying to wonder where I have that tendency in my life to strip out the culture, but I don't know. I like to also just jump into a culture. Zilla has become Zilla. I just said it like as if I'm still living there.
In a way, we will never leave
Zilla. We'll never leave Zilla. But in our area, there's a high, high Hispanic population here. A lot of Mexicans here. And it's kind of fun. There's a lot of culture about it that I'm like, I don't think you should bring that little piece of culture with you. Yeah. But being able to enjoy.
But the food.
But the right, food. Yeah. Hospitality. I mean,
the value that they put on mothers.
One of my good friends at my work, the culture around when I lost my mom, I got to experience the honor that Hispanic people have for their mothers as generally culturally, by their, you know, just like, I had multiple friends coming up to me, my Hispanic friends coming up to me, and like they were on the verge of tears or weeping for me because I was like about to lose my mom. Mm-hmm. And they were just like telling me all these stories of how they honored either their parents when they were losing them, or giving me advice like, just be with her and like be close to her. And it was like, wow, like I got to experience a little bit of their culture.
Here we took a collection for funeral expenses, you know, here, make, you know, take the day off, Jim. I specifically took care of this thing for you tomorrow, so you don't have to worry about it.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was very powerful of being able to put on that or get to see some of their cultural values. And instead of just like, if you strip off all of the fiestas from the Hispanic, if you strip off all of the...
If you take all the holidays away and...
If you take away their tacos and their... Enchiladas
and pozole.
And their pozole. And then it's like, well, that's boring. Why would I want that?
I mean, ultimately, you have to strip everyone of their language.
Yeah. C.S. Lewis, I think one of the books that he explores this idea is in the Ransom Trilogy, the last book, That Hideous Strength. The scientists are trying to make a pure intellect. At the college, like these possessed scientists are trying to make a pure intellect devoid of all limitations and all culture. And what they wanted was a brain in a box. What they actually worshipped was a detached human brain, like that had grown in monstrous size because it was outside of a skull and like hooked up to a bunch of tubes and was swimming in a bath of liquid. And they're like, oh, go ask the brain. But that was what they were worshiping. They wanted to like strip it all away. And at the end of the story, when the good guys are victorious, you can see the culture coming back, especially when the culture of the husband and wife, they were growing farther and farther apart from each other. And at the very end, like the embracing of each other. And I guess it's not so much culture. I was just talking about like the sex scene at the end when there's like all of the animals are doing it.
Okay, look, there is culture there too, but let's...
We can skip past that. I was like building up to that point, and I was like, there. Wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think that ending on sex is a good idea. Let's go ahead and pull the plug, Jim.
Are you sure you don't want to have any more comments there, Jared?
I think we're doing great.
Try that again.
Jaren, you really think that? Have you seen yourself without a shirt on?
Oh, man.
I mean... Oh.